Let's turn to God's Word, Matthew 14, beginning in verse 22. It's on page 820. Immediately, Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side while he dismissed the crowds. And after he had dismissed the crowds, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when evening came, he was there alone. But the boat by this time was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. And in the fourth watch of the night, Jesus came to them, walking on the sea. But when the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified and said, "It's a ghost." And they cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter answered him, "Lord, if it's you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." So Peter got out of the boat and he walked on water and came to Jesus. But when he saw the wind, he was afraid. And beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." And Jesus immediately reached out his hand, took hold of him, saying to him, "Oh, you of little faith, why did you doubt?" And when they got into the boat, the wind ceased. And those in the boat worshiped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." This is the word of the Lord. Well, we're in this series looking at the real Jesus, and we're in the subsection kind of interactions. We're looking at how Jesus interacts with people around him, and we're kind of picking out different kinds of interactions. So 2 weeks ago, we saw him with Zacchaeus, and we saw Jesus giving immense kindness to a person that really didn't deserve it. And then last week, we saw Jesus' interaction with the Pharisees. And we saw that though Jesus gave immense kindness to Zacchaeus, he was that much more opposed to the Pharisees. This week, we're going to see something a little different. This week, we're looking at his interaction with an insider, one of his guys, Peter. We're going to do this, we're going to go kind of line by line through this story. So my suggestion, as always, is to keep the scriptures open or your orders of worship. If you want to write notes in the middle of that, that's a good thing too. But we're going to go line by line through this. So let's start for a minute. Verse 22, it says, immediately. Three times this word immediately is used. It's a very important word. And I think it points to Jesus' sovereignty and control over what's going on. But it says, immediately after feeding the 5,000, Jesus sends the disciples to go ahead of him to the other side of the Sea of Galilee. Now I have a question about this. Why does Jesus send the disciples ahead on the Sea of Galilee to cross to the other side? I mean, the Sea of Galilee, it's not like you can walk around it very easily. It's the size of the Mobile Bay. And he's just fed everybody. He says, "Okay, guys, you get in the boat. You go to the other side." How is Jesus going to get there? His ride just left. Think he knows something of what's going to happen? Likely. I think it's an indication of the fact that Jesus is, from the beginning, he understands what exactly is happening in this event, what's going to happen. He's in complete control and command of what's going on here. Verse 23, it says, he went away to pray. Now, this is a little side road off for a second, but I think this verse, it says something about the primacy and the necessity of prayer. In a basic sense, if Jesus does it, it's probably a good idea that we do it. But more than that, it says something about Jesus. That Jesus goes off and spends significant time in prayer is an indication that he's not some, you know, like some one-off, on his own, God doing as he says. That Jesus is constantly through his life and ministry standing in the middle of Trinitarian relationship. That at all times, he is standing in submission to the Father and relying on the power of the Spirit to do everything. And so he has to pray. So he goes up on a mountain and he spends significant time there because prayer is primary. It's necessary for Jesus. Verse 24, Jesus is up on the mountain. And I imagine that he's looking down and he can kind of see what's going on with the boat. And it's interesting because he sends the boat out, it says, immediately after dinner. He feeds the 5,000, he sends the disciples out. And then it says, the boat was a long way from the land, beaten by the waves, for the wind was against them. It's the middle of the night. There is a big storm. The waves are crashing. The boat is swaying. Death is impending. This is you. This is what the scriptures are saying. The scriptures are saying, this is your life. It's turbulent. It's windy. The boat might go upside down at any point in time. This is your life. Scripture's describing this. I mean, you know, did good days feel like paddling against the waves? That bad days are like you're in the pitch black and you don't know which way you're going. That's us in that boat. And that storm and those waves are the trials that we're going through. Verse 25, it says, in the fourth watch of the night. Now, this is something like 4 a.m. This is deep in the middle of the night, right before the dawn, and Jesus comes to them, and I love that it takes him so long to get out to the disciples, that he's been watching them struggle and he's paddling and paddle against the waves. But Jesus has thought, it's more necessary for me to sit here and pray than it is to go out and save these guys. He knew what he was going to do. He was in control of everything. It's the fourth watch of the night. And Jesus goes out to them walking on water. Walking on water. This is a very visible, tangible, right in front of you miracle by Jesus. And it is his way of coming to them that is going to show us that something more is going on here than turning water to wine or multiplying the loaves or even raising a dead person. This is something more significant is going on in this miracle than just simply walking on water. And here's why we know that. Because verse 26, when the disciples saw Jesus coming, they were terrified. Fear is a big deal in this story, but it's an even bigger deal at this particular point in time because they see Jesus coming at them and they're scared because they're like us. Real people don't walk on water. That's not what happens. And so they think it's a ghost. They think it's the devil impersonating Jesus. They're not sure what it is, and they cry out in fear. And see, the role of fear here, it's a billboard pointing to something bigger. Every time that God shows up in the Bible, every time that an angelic being of God shows up in a Bible, you know what people's reaction is? They're scared. People are always scared when God shows up. That's what's happening here. Verse 27, in response to their fear, Jesus says, take heart, it is I, do not be afraid. Now, this is the other thing that always happens whenever God or an angelic being shows up. There's always the initial fear by the one who's the human being, but then the response by the angelic being is always, don't be scared. I think the most used phrase in the Bible is, do not be afraid. There is a pattern going on here. There is something happening. The scriptures are telling us that this is not a normal interaction that's going on. Because look, I mean, we know Jesus is a heavenly being. That's not news to anybody. It's not news particularly to the disciples at this point. They know this guy is special. Why then are they scared of his presence at this point? This is not the way that they usually react to Jesus. You don't hear of them being scared of him whenever he walks up after being gone for a while. Something special is going on here. And it's what we call a theophany. Theophany is a word that means God showing up. It's this breaking forth of the unveiled glory of God in space and in time. That's why this is not a normal miracle. That what's happening here is Jesus is peeling back something of his glory that people could see it. And we know that there is a sense in which he walks around with a veiled glory, because if he didn't, man, people would be smoted. People would be falling to the ground left and right. And when you read the Gospels, that's not everybody's reaction to Jesus. This is a theophany. This is a specific kind of unveiling of the true identity of Jesus. They're scared. He tells them not to be scared. But there's something more that tells us that this is a unique unveiling of the glory. It's what he tells them. Jesus says, take heart, it is I. Now, the Greek here is ego eimi, and ego eimi is the Greek translation of a Hebrew phrase called I am. And I am has a very unique place in the people of Israel. I am is the divine sacred name that God's people call the Lord of heaven and earth. When Moses is being told to go to the people and free them from Egypt, Moses says, I'll go, but you have to tell me your name. And God says, my name is I am. My name is I am who I am. I will be who I will be. And Jesus comes to them walking on the water and he says, ego eimi, take heart, I am. He's not mixing any punches here. This is the unveiled glory of God standing before these disciples. He's claiming the sacred divine name of the God of Israel. He's saying, that is who I am. Verse 28. I love this. Peter sees the glory of Jesus. He hears the claim. And he perfectly responds. He says this, Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you. Now, I think it's interesting because, you know, and maybe this is just being in Christian circles, but oftentimes we kind of look down on Peter because he's kind of an impetuous idiot, it seems, most of the time. And we identify, we like to see people that are dumber than us. It makes us feel good about ourselves. And I think there's a danger in thinking that that's what's happening in this story, that Peter's being a bit impetuous. He's being a bit naive and dumb and doing this. No. Peter is dead on. Peter is understanding something better and more quickly than everybody else who is in the boat that night. Peter looks at Jesus and hears him say, I am, and he thinks to himself, that's God, and if it is God, then he can command me to walk on the water. Peter understands the implications of the glory and the power of the gospel in a way that nobody else in the boat does. Probably in a way that none of us in this room do. We'd probably be a little bit different if we understood it that way. But consider his request a little bit more deeply. So Peter sees Jesus. He says, command me to come out. But think about the request for a minute. Because I go to Spring Hill Swim Club. And I've tried this before. If you see me, it's kind of a weird thing. Sometimes I'll think to myself, like, I want to just see if I can walk on water. You ever do that? You ever go on a pool? You're like, maybe it'll happen for me this time, and I'll be that guy that everybody tells a story about. And I'll stand on the edge, and I'll put my foot out and I'll lean forward. Splat, right? Face plant right into the water. And you know what happens next? I sink to the bottom. But of course, all I do is just swim up and get out of the pool and dry off and keep sitting there and going on with my life, right? It's not a big risk to try water walking in a pool. That is not the case for Peter here. There is much at stake for Peter in this request to walk on the water. I mean, remember where we are again. It's the middle of the night. You're on the Mobile Bay. There's a huge storm. Waves are crashing. This is not swimming water. If he gets out of the boat, he could sink to the bottom. He could be carried by a current and they could not see him and never find him again. There is a lot at stake in this request by Peter to swim in the middle of a violent storm, to walk on the water in the middle of a violent storm. Jesus says to him, come, verse 29. I think it's so great that he asks Jesus to do this and Jesus allows it to happen. I don't know why. I just could imagine Jesus being like, just stay in the boat. It's not for you. But Jesus says, okay, yeah, you get it, Peter. Come. Peter gets out of the boat. It says Peter got out of the boat. He walked on water and he came to Jesus. And I've wondered, you know, as I've leaned over that pool sometimes, what was that first step like? What was he thinking about with the buoyancy of the water? And I think the truth is, he wasn't thinking about anything with the water or with the storm or with the winds. His eyes were fixed on Jesus, the God of the universe standing before him. And I think he just jumped out of the boat. And he started walking, and clearly he walked a distance because it says he walked and he came to Jesus. He made it some period, some couple of yards or whatever it was. But then verse 30, it says, but Peter saw. Peter saw the wind and he was afraid and he began to sink. Where did his eyes go? He went to the blowing wind and the crashing waves, and he begins to sink. Now, this whole scenario is not a normal paradigm, obviously, for how water works. You guys are, I don't know, some of you are pretty smart. I mean, others of them is up for a question, but I mean, I guess most of us understand like what liquids are and that they're not solids. And that as Peter steps off the boat, that what would normally happen is a normal person would sink. But for some reason, in his divine sovereignty, Jesus has deemed the rules of water walking to include a sinking provision that is not gravity. It is not liquid. That what makes Peter sink is not those things. It is something spiritual. What causes his falling down is not that one cannot walk on water. It is that there's something of doubt coming up inside of Peter. Obviously, Jesus is teaching us something other than how to walk on water. That is not what this story is about. This is a metaphor. There is a lesson that Jesus is teaching. It's a statement about how you walk through life. And here's the statement Jesus is making. It's not the size, but the eyes. Jesus is saying, it doesn't matter how big the waves are around you. It doesn't matter the trial. It doesn't matter the obstacle. It doesn't matter the suffering. It doesn't matter the pain. It doesn't matter the impossibility of these things. It is about where your eyes are fixated. And the question that he's putting to Peter and that he's putting to us is, are your eyes fixated on the size of the waves, or are they fixated on the one who walked on the water and created the waves in the first place? There's a great story about this in the Old Testament. Numbers 13 and 14. The Israelites have been wandering in the desert and they're about to go into the land. God's commanded to give them this promised land. And they're to go in and conquer it. And they send out spies to scope the land out. And the spies come back. And some of the spies say this. They say, oh, the land is good. Milk and honey. Beautiful, great, wonderful. But their cities are fortified. Their people are like giants. And we are like grasshoppers. We should not go. We should stay back. We should return to Egypt. We will die in this battle. And one Caleb stands up in the middle of it. And I love this story. Because what Caleb does not do is refute the facts. Caleb doesn't say, no, 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 they got it wrong. They're not very big. We're pretty strong. Their cities are weak. I know something here. No, no, no. Caleb just assumes all of that stuff. And he stands up in front of them. And basically what he says is, it's not the size, it's the eyes. He says, if God is with us, if we will not rebel, if we will remain faithful, keep our gaze on the God who parted the ocean for us, then we will prevail. Caleb says the battle is in God's hands. Fix your eyes on him. It's not the size, it's the eyes. Think about raising kids. I mean, the further I get along in it, the more I think it is a near impossible task. I mean, you start realizing all the things that you want. You know, you want your kids to grow up and you want them to have faith in Christ. You want them to have a values and moral system. You want them to be educated. You want them to have a work ethic. You want them to have a good sense of what it would be to pick a spouse and go, you know, on and on. All these sort of things that you're constantly trying to instill into a group of people that don't want anything instilled into them. It's a possible task. And even more so when you begin to think about the world around it. People are always saying to me, Alec, you know, you don't understand how hard it is. The way things are with kids today, and they're right. You know, kids today, they have these phones and they can see things, do things, organize themselves in ways that we never could when we were kids. It took a lot of effort to organize trouble when we were kids. Now all you gotta do is Snapchat it, you know, text message it. I mean, we live in a far less Christian society than we did, than a lot of you did when you were growing up. There are far more influences of evil constantly after our kids than we were when we were growing up. And all of it just sort of adds up to, it feels like this impossible storm. The wind is swirling and the waves are crashing and the enemy is a giant and we are grasshoppers, and you start thinking about it, and what happens is you start sinking. You get paralyzed. You get angry. You get hopeless. You get anxious about everything that's going on. And Jesus is saying it's not the size. It's the eyes. You know, I think if Caleb and Joshua were writing a parenting book from Numbers 13, you know, their parenting book might be something like this. Look, yeah, the world is a really hard place. Phones are a terrible invention for people who can't handle them. There are lots of bad, evil things that are going around trying to suck our children up. But guess what? It doesn't matter. Keep your eyes on Jesus. It'll be all right. I've never read a parenting book like that. You know why? Because they don't exist. You can't sell a book doing that. What people want is advice about how they can fix things. They want a technique. They want a motivation. They want something that has to do with them. And Jesus says to ones like this, look, it's not about you. It's about me. Fix your gaze on me. I mean, It's a storm out there. Did y'all get woken up last night in the middle of the night? We had sirens going at my house. And I jump out of bed, 3:30 in the morning. I jump out of the bed, and I'm like running down the halls. I'm thinking, tornado's coming. This is it. You know, we're going down. I'm going to grab a kid. Arden's like, stop, stop. It's not our siren. I'm thinking, not our siren. How do you figure out if it's not our siren or not? We're going to die. And I'm running down the hallway from a dead sleep, and there's all my kids' bedrooms are right in front of me. And as she's saying, stop, I'm thinking to myself, I got to make a decision about which kid I'm going to save here in this tornado. Like, it's a storm. I got to grab one. Which way do I go? It wasn't you, Caleb. Sorry. Sorry, buddy. I mean, it's a storm out there. You know, it's a constant tornado. That's the way life is. In verse 30 and 31, Peter starts sinking just like we do. He does something right. He cries out to Jesus. He says this, Lord, save me. Save me. You know, I read this story, and the first thing that always grabs my attention is the doubt of Peter, and I want to blame Peter for these things. Look, you can blame Peter, you can think that there's a weakness here, but I don't think that's what Jesus is doing. I don't think it's what Jesus does here. Look at the order of events and the way this thing happens. Very important. Peter starts walking, he begins to doubt, he sinks in the water, he cries out to the Lord, and what does the Lord do? He doesn't say to him, hey, you shouldn't have doubted. Are you still doubting? If you don't doubt, I'll pick you up. That's not what Jesus does. Jesus immediately reaches out his hands. And he grabs Peter, and he saves him. And then he says to Peter, oh, Peter, you have little faith. Why did you doubt? And when he says it, I don't think he does it to embarrass or to castigate Peter. I think he does it to teach Peter something. To say, Peter, you need to keep your eyes focused on me. But there's going to come a time when the waves are going to seem big. They're going to capture me. They're going to arrest me. They're going to try me. They're going to beat me. They're going to crucify me. The enemy's going to seem big. All is going to seem lost. Fix your gaze on me in that moment. Something more is going to happen. Of course, you know what Peter does. He doubts. Just like he does here. And Jesus, after he's resurrected, comes back and he picks Peter up and restores Peter just like he does in this story. And here's the gospel for you this morning. You need faith to walk with God. But ultimately, it doesn't rest on your faith. It's not the size of your faith that counts. It's the person for whom your eyes are fixated. And the reason I know that, if you walked a day with Jesus, you know there are these moments you'll have an amazing conviction of his glory. You will walk on water. You will enter life with fearlessness and faith like you've never seen before. And you'll wake up the next day and you'll be a bucket of doubt. It happens to me every Sunday afternoon. You'll be a worthless believer. You'll be angry. You'll be hopeless. You'll be questioning, is God real? And guess what Jesus does in that moment? He saves then, just like he did initially. That Jesus comes and he picks Peter up in the middle of his doubt, and he restores Peter in the middle of his three-time denial of him, and he does the same for you. Faith is called for in the Christian life. But the Christian life doesn't rest on your faith. It rests on the mercy of Jesus Christ. And just as you needed the mercy and the grace of Jesus to be saved, so you need the mercy and grace of Jesus to walk with him, to be sanctified with him. You don't start with grace and finish with works. That's not the gospel. The gospel is we're doubting, we're stumbling, we're messing up, we're things that we know better than to do, and in the middle of it all, the one right thing you can do, cry out, Lord, save me, and Jesus immediately picks up. Verse 32 and 33. We're going to end with this. And I love the ending of this story because I think this is the point of everything that Jesus is doing here. They get back to the boat, and everybody in the boat worships Christ by saying, truly, you are the Son of God. They marvel at Jesus, and they marvel at Jesus in part because Peter was so clearly a doubter. Consider this for a minute. If Peter had jumped out of that boat, and he had run around and done circles on the water and danced and then jumped back in, I could see his buddies just dogpiling him when he get in. Man, that was awesome. I can't believe you did that. That was incredible. And there would have been something of shared glory with Jesus for Peter in that moment. And here's what we know about our God. He is jealous for his own glory. He will not share his glory with another. And that's why the doubting and the sinking of Peter serve nothing more than the glory of Christ. It points to who the real power is. It highlights the uniqueness of Jesus. It demonstrates the perfection of the Son of God over and against the weak, stumbling, doubting faith of the man Peter. And that's why the point of this story is not verse 29, it's verse 33. The point of this story is not Peter walking on water or Peter stumbling into water or any of that stuff. The point of the story is that Jesus Christ is worshiped as the true Son of God. And I think that's the point of your life. I don't think that the point of your life is to raise perfect kids. I don't think the point of your life is to be successful. I don't think the point of your life is to make it in every endeavor in which you go out and be. The point, I think, is not you at all. The point is the glory of God. And sometimes your stumblings and your inadequacies shout the glory of God more than your talents and your successes and your victories. Keep your eyes on Jesus. We don't have enough faith to do that. Cry out, Lord, save me. And when he reaches out his hands to save you, let Jesus' saving mercy be to the praise of his glorious grace. Let's pray.